The headlines: Palestinians hold a funeral for a former political prisoner who was recently released from an Israeli prison after his health condition seriously deteriorated. Black and minority ethnic girls in England are reportedly more than twice as likely to be excluded from school as their white counterparts. And Iran's foreign minister tells his British counterpart that Tehran seeks action rather than words from the signatories of the 2015 nuclear deal. Hello and welcome everybody. Here in the Iranian capital, Tehran, this is World News. Our top story for this half-hour: Palestinians have held a funeral in the city of Bethlehem for a cancer-stricken inmate who died after being recently released from an Israeli jail on health grounds. Hossein Mosalma was abducted by the Israeli military in 2002 and sentenced to 20 years in prison. While in detention, he had been denied urgently needed medical treatment for leukemia. The Palestinian Prisoners Society says the Israeli regime is fully responsible for his death, especially since Mosalma was subject to medical negligence. Prior to the funeral, various Palestinian groups had launched a general strike in Bethlehem and called for protests across the occupied territories. Recently, Palestinians in the West Bank and the Gaza Strip have called a number of mass rallies against the Israeli regime's mistreatment of Palestinian inmates. Our Ramallah correspondent Mona Kandil says Palestinian prisoners are in Israeli jails are being kept in terrible conditions and denied their basic rights.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails are not having all their rights behind bars. We are speaking about thousands of Palestinians being incarcerated in very difficult situation in the Israeli jails. Hundreds of them are suffering from different and various forms of illness. Some are in serious conditions, like what happened with Hossein Mosalma, this Palestinian former prisoner, 39 years old, from Al-Khadr town. And Palestinians in the village of Al-Khadr, as well as in Bethlehem, are demanding the international community to interfere and save other Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails who need immediate medical intervention because the Israeli authorities continue to impose medical negligence against the Palestinian prisoners.
Hundreds of Israeli settlers backed by regime forces have stormed the Al-Aqsa Mosque compound in occupied East Al-Quds. Palestinian media say the settlers, guarded by troops, invaded the courtyards of the mosque. Israeli settlers regularly storm the complex to perform their religious rituals there. This is while under a guardianship agreement between Israel and Jordan, non-Islamic worship is prohibited at the site. In July, Israeli settlers broke into the compound ahead of the Muslim feast of Eid al-Adha, with the regime forces attacking Muslim worshippers and detaining a number of them. Also in May, the regime's crackdown on Palestinian worshippers at the mosque prompted an 11-day war between Palestinian resistance groups in the Gaza Strip and Israel. Well, one more convoy carrying fuel oil from the first Iranian shipment to Lebanon has arrived in the country from Syria. This is a new batch of tanker convoys entering Lebanon since the Iranian vessel docked in Syria's Banias port. Iran is providing Lebanon with fuel oil in a bid to help the country overcome its crippling energy crisis. We're now joined by our Beirut correspondent, Mariam Saleh, for more on the topic. Mariam, what details do you have to share with us regarding this consignment of fuel?
Well, this is probably part of the convoy. It's going to be a long convoy, of course, as we heard from Hezbollah Secretary General Sayed Hassan Nasrallah, stressed that the issue is not one ship or two ships. We're not going to be counting ships, but what we know is there's going to be a very long convoy of fuel that will be provided to Lebanon until the government can take over or find perhaps a solution to the current crisis. Now, although Hezbollah has been able to fill the gap when it comes to diesel oil, and which is something very necessary to many vehicles and to providing electricity, especially to institutions that need it most, like hospitals, orphanages, other institutions that have been in a state that were in a very, very critical state, actually, especially when we're talking about paramedics and so on, and for hospital ambulances They needed that diesel in addition to houses as well. They needed it to ensure that they have for their generators enough diesel to provide electricity for their homes, because the electricity that the government's providing is basically non-existent. You have around 2 or 4 hours of electricity a day only. Now, of course, despite all of this, we still have the general fuel crisis, the gasoline crisis. You still have long lines of cars lining up at the gas stations waiting to fill their cars. That is an issue that we are waiting to see if Hezbollah, as we heard from Hezbollah Secretary General, that the third ship should include gasoline for vehicles. That should be coming in soon. We don't know exactly from Hezbollah when the second or third ship will be arriving. However, the first two ships, since they have the same type of fuel, that's not going to be significant when the second ship arrives. So what is important is the third ship, because that will actually help break the black market, because you still have people today buying gasoline from the black market at a very high price. This has led also to the lack of fuel in many areas, where even some gas stations are selling also in the black market, in addition to making people wait for hours and hours until they get their gasoline. Of course, this is very significant. As we mentioned earlier, the shipment does not only break the siege that is against Lebanon, that was, of course, non-declared by the U.S. against not only Hezbollah, against the entire country, but this also is a challenge to the U.S. sanctions against the Islamic Republic of Iran and the Caesar Act against Syria, because the gas, the fuel is coming from Syria into Lebanon with vehicles, huge tankers. Now, we're talking about more than 2 million gallons of fuel that has already reached Lebanon. We're already seeing the difference in the generation of electricity. Of course, we're hoping that the third ship will be able to bring in and make a change when it comes to the gasoline crisis.
All right, thanks a lot. Mariam Pasala joining us from the Lebanese capital, Beirut. Elsewhere, black and minority ethnic girls in England are more than twice as likely to be excluded from school as their white counterparts. That's according to data uncovered by Agenda Group campaigning for the most excluded women. The data shows black Caribbean girls were permanently excluded from school at a rate double that of white British girls during the autumn term in both 2018 and 19, and 2019 to 20. The figure was three times as high for mixed white and Caribbean girls. During the same period, girls from Gypsy, Roma, and traveler communities faced permanent exclusion that were four times higher than those of white British girls. Boys continue to face higher rates of exclusion overall. The report notes that the number of girls excluded is increasing. Iran's foreign minister says Tehran has so far not seen any tangible action on the part of the U.S. and Europe regarding halted talks aimed at reviving the 2015 Iran nuclear deal. Hossein Amin Abdullahian made the remarks during a meeting with his British counterpart Liz Truss on the sidelines of this week's UN General Assembly in New York. He said the U.S., Europe's silence and abetting continues to impose sanctions on Iran while claiming to return to the agreement. The top Iranian diplomat described the U.S. position as a clear contradiction. He added that the reconstruction of ties between Iran and Britain requires adopting serious measures, stressing that London needs to repay its four-decade-long debt to Iran. Amir Abdullahian also met a number of other foreign diplomats at his first appearance at the General Assembly. Political commentator Kindo Zhu says it's Washington's responsibility to return to the Iran nuclear deal as it had withdrawn from the accord unilaterally.
I think the Iranian side obviously has more than enough reasons to complain about the dragging feet by Washington in the return to the JCPOA, the nuclear deal, 2015, reached in that time. We remember it's Trump administration which withdrew in 2018 from JCPOA. I think it's really up to the United States, and the U.S. should take the responsibility. It's not the responsibility of the Iranians.
Muslim pilgrims are streaming into Iraq's holy city of Karbala ahead of the Day of Arba'in. The pilgrims are converging on the city for the annual event that marks the 40th day after the martyrdom anniversary of Imam Hussein, the grandson of Prophet Muhammad. This year, Irvine falls on September 28th. Every year, the occasion draws millions of pilgrims, but the Iraqi government has restricted the number of foreign visitors since last year due to the coronavirus pandemic. Imam Hussein and his 72 companions were martyred in the unequal battle of Karbala with troops of the tyrant ruler of their time over 13 centuries ago. The battle known as the Ashura event is one of the most important religious occasions marked by Muslims. The Venezuelan president has called for the lifting of sanctions imposed by the United States and the European Union on his country. Nicolas Maduro made the remarks in his speech to the United Nations General Assembly. He said sanctions prevent Venezuelan oil and mining companies from selling their products. Maduro denounced what he called permanent, systematic aggression waged against Venezuela through these restrictions. The Venezuelan president called for the establishment of a new world free of colonialism and imperialism. Commentator Nicholas Ayala says, the ultimate goal of sanctions imposed by imperialist powers is to halt the progress and development in independent countries.
The global issue that we're facing today is an issue of imperialism, of hegemony, specifically Western hegemony. And that is really what's driving a lot of these issues that we see in Cuba and Iran and Venezuela. It's the main force behind the blockades and the sanctions. And we've seen the damage that blockades and sanctions have done in many of these nations. These sanctions, these blockades, are evil, or are essentially attacking the progress that many of these nations could make, and in essence stunting their development and their growth. And that's really the goal of these imperialist sanctions.
The chairman of the U.S. Federal Reserve has warned that failure to pay government debts would do severe damage to the economy. Jerome Powell called on U.S. lawmakers to raise the nation's borrowing limit urgently. He also warned that the Federal Reserve or anyone else cannot protect the markets or the economy in the event of failure by the government to pay its debts. However, the opposition leader in the Senate has steadfastly refused to cooperate with the majority-holding Democrats to increase the debt ceiling. Officials have warned that it could lead to chaos in financial markets. Colin Campbell explained the possible consequences should Congress fail to raise the debt ceiling.
But right now, because we are in such polarized political times, you have Republicans who refuse to help Democrats and authorize the debt ceiling raise. Now, we've seen what happens before when it comes to the U.S. defaulting and not raising the debt ceiling. We've seen our credit rating go down. We've seen national parks close. We've seen outrage coming from some members of the public, some politicians. But altogether, the debt ceiling is usually raised. It's usually part of just what politicians are supposed to be doing. But right now, things are very partisan. Republicans want Democrats to take all the blame for raising the debt ceiling so that they can use it as political fodder in upcoming elections, saying, see, look how much Democrats are spending. They're spending all the money. They're tax and spend liberals. This is costing you taxpayers more money in the end. That's why you need to vote them out of office. It goes on and on and on. Many people expect that the debt ceiling will be raised, and right now it'll be incumbent upon the Democrats to handle this responsibility solely because Republicans will not give them the assist.
A U.S. federal judge has reportedly ordered Facebook to hand over records of accounts linked to anti-Rohingya violence in Myanmar that the social networking firm had shut down in 2018. A Wall Street Journal report says a judge in Washington, D.C., also criticized Facebook for refusing to provide details to investigators seeking to prosecute Myanmarese officials for their crimes against Rohingya. There's no comment yet from Facebook over the ruling. The American multinational technology company had cited U.S. law for its actions, saying electronic communication services are barred from disclosing users' communications. More than 700,000 Rohingya Muslims fled Myanmar following a military-led crackdown. In 2017, there were harrowing accounts of killing, torture, and rape of Rohingya men and women. The United Nations says the crackdown was perpetrated with genocidal intentions. Tens of thousands of Rohingya refugees in India are facing a barrage of detention and vicious expulsion campaigns since the emergence of the Hindu nationalist government, which calls them a security threat. Data by Indian Crime Records Agency shows that Myanmar nationals accounted for just 2% of the total crimes allegedly committed by foreigners. Dwanar Zaman has more in this report.
from their homes, the battle for survival continues for thousands of Rohingya refugees living across India. After fleeing war-ravaged Myanmar and what the UN described as ethnic cleansing, they are now trying to rebuild their shattered lives in different parts of the world. But in India, they are sometimes called illegal immigrants and threat to national security, which activists describe as a deliberate attempt to target a particular community. Apparently, they are also accused of illegal activities, but these claims were not reflected in the recently released National Crime Records Bureau analysis.
There is no evidence whatsoever about Rohingyas being involved in anything even close to terrorist activity. This is the paranoia of the Indian deep state, which increasingly wants to do all this fear-mongering to increase its budget.
Based on analysis of the Government Crime Records Agency for 2020, Myanmar nationals accounted for just 2% of the total crimes allegedly committed by foreigners. Analysts say there is no case of terror, rape, or keeping arms against any Rohingya refugee, which belies the government claim of calling them a security threat.
We just want to stay alive. We are no threat to anyone since we are humans and have family too. We are really in a miserable state as a detention and expulsion campaign is going on.
Based on official estimates, some 40,000 Rohingya refugees are living in parts of India. Many refugees I spoke with had almost similar views. They say they felt safe in India since they arrived, but over the last few years, hate campaigns against the community are haunting them. As refugee crises continue to be the biggest challenge facing the world, rights activists say Rohingya community in particular has largely been ignored despite the levels of atrocities it has endured, both at home and as refugees. They say India needs to rethink and redraw its refugee policy regardless of the geostrategic interest and stand by its ethos considering the world as a family. Minority Rohingya Muslims have for decades fled to neighboring Bangladesh and other countries, including India, escaping genocide in their country. Regardless of the refugee crisis across the world, the community continues to be neglected and unseen victims of violence. Munawar Zaman in the outskirts of New Delhi.
Russia has reported 820 more coronavirus-related deaths in the past 24 hours amid concerns of a new wave of infections. This is the second time Russia's daily fatalities have reached an all-time one-day high in less than a month. The country also registered more than 21,400 new infections on Thursday, pushing the overall caseload to 7.35 million. Russian officials have already warned about a looming fourth wave of infections in the country. The surge has been blamed on easing restrictions. Opening of workplaces and schools following these summer holidays, Russia's efforts to contain the pandemic have been hampered by public reluctance to get vaccinated. So far, just over 20% of the total population has been fully vaccinated. And that brings us to an end here on this edition of the World News. Do stay tuned, though. Bye.
Comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Dark Review.
Hello and welcome to Doc Review with me, Camelia Shambayati. In today's show, we're discussing Those Who Feel the Fire Burning. And joining me in the studio, we have Lee Singer, who is a film journalist and video essayist, whose work has appeared in various major newspapers, magazines, and online outlets. He is also a program advisor for the BFI London Film Festival. And Nassim Ahmed, who is a political analyst and writer for Middle East Monitor. Now, Those Who Feel the Fire Burning, directed and written by Morgan Kanibe, is an unconventional, artistic, and powerful documentary about the refugee crisis. The film shows the level of poverty, humiliation, and other afflictions the refugees have to endure as they are stuck in a hopeless situation on the borders of Europe. Welcome both of you to the show. Thanks very much for coming on. Now, that was a very emotional documentary. Lee, if I can start with you first. Now, there's been a wave of documentaries about the refugee crisis. What makes this documentary so unique and different?
Well, I think the first question is it even a straight documentary? I mean, definitions are very fluid, but I would term it an essay film, which is a film that kind of blurs the lines between fiction and documentary and is often operating in a kind of very sort of meditative or contemplative tone with a sort of very, you know, focused first-person thing. And what they do in this film with this kind of free-floating, you know, disembodied point of view is...
You're sort of a wandering ghost, aren't you?
At the beginning there's a very harrowing shipwreck, and it's as if one of the people who didn't make it from that crossing is now sort of wandering as a sort of spirit around Europe and sort of encountering various, refugees and sort of experiencing a little bit of each of their stories. So in that sense, it's very unconventional, but very striking as a result.
Mm-hmm. And Nassim, if I could go to you next. What was your take on Those Who Feel the Fire Burning?
Well, when I first watched it, I mean, I agree with Lee. I mean, it's very immersive. It really takes you into the life of a refugee and their experiences, but there isn't a grand narrative. Most documentaries, as we know, they have a clear idea as to where they're going, and you get a sense of what the problem is, what the issues are, mm-hmm. and even maybe, you know, recommend some solutions to those problems. That's usually the format of a documentary, but here you're left with lots of questions, background questions as to where they're from, you know, who are these people? I mean, we know they're refugees, but where are they from? What's their story? Why is this person taking drugs? So it immerses you into their experiences, but leaves me lots and lots of questions about their background and stuff like that.
And that's exactly what I would like to actually ask you about while you're here, to give some context to this situation. Now, this documentary was made a few years ago, but the refugee crisis is still ongoing. So would you say that this documentary will stay relevant for years to come?
I think the experiences of these refugees will be relevant for a long, long time, because these are shared experiences. These are people who have left their homes, and this is a shared experience throughout the world. Anyone who leaves their homes to a different land, they will face this kind of subjugations, and they will be living on the margins of society. That's how most refugees live. So from an emotional perspective, from this visceral connection which you have with refugees, I think that would be that would stay with you from a as a form of art for many, many years to come. But in terms of providing context and information about the real issues about facing refugees in Europe, I don't think it really touches on those issues much. Like, for example, 5 million refugees coming from Syria, and how that's affecting the socio-political climate within Europe, how that's changing the demography within Europe, and the insecurities it's creating, the political turmoil it's led to. So those kind of questions is not even addressed by the documentary. But in terms of, as I said, as a program which touches on the feelings and the emotions of refugees, I think it will stay with us for a long, long time.
Lee, would you have liked to have seen that, some more political context, some sort of the questions raised while watching this documentary?
It's a tricky one, because on one hand, I really admire the sort of artistry and you know, trying to frame a film about this subject in an entirely different way. It's much more like a sort of Terrence Malick film, you know, with the sort of free-flowing narration. You don't even know who's talking sometimes, or it's not necessarily connected to most traditional feature or documentary films about refugees. You follow a small number of protagonists, and like you say, there's a clear, we're here, we need to get to here, and this is the goal. And so they follow a very sort of traditional narrative thing. Michael Winterbottom's In This World, or Diego Quesada Diaz's The Golden Dream. You know who these people are, and so it's the film's counting on you to empathize with and then put yourself in the place of those characters. Because this film is doing this much more sort of free-floating, sort of collage-type thing, it maybe loses that direct connection. It's trying to put you in the point of view of someone you don't ever see.
Yes.
And so therefore, that sort of, you know, empathy that we traditionally get in films of, that's our character, how would I react in that situation? It's not trying to do that. So it loses the sort of specifics that Nazima, and you know, where are we? How long have they been there? All of these facts and sort of details are, you know, deliberately omitted, but it's much more after a sort of experiential type thing. And, you know, there are pros and cons to that approach. I find it very interesting as a film, but if I was studying, you know, if I was trying to understand the refugee crisis in Europe from this film, I'd be left, as Nazim said, with a lot more questions than I had at the beginning.
Well, there's some really great, interesting points that you made. But I have to say, I really love the transitions between places we see. I think it's quite beautiful. And Lee, we see a refugee child there. What kind of conditions do we see them exposed to in this documentary?
Oh, it's horrific. I mean, it's, you know, and, you know, what it's showing there is what we've seen so many times also in the news, you know, horrendous scenes of children. Because those are, you know, as much as your heart goes out to anybody in those situations, when it's children who obviously have no concept of the wider, you know, implications and ramifications of what's going on, it's horrific. I mean, from what I've read, the UNHCR website talks about like over 65 million displaced people, over 22 million refugees like at right now, and over 50% of those are under 18. So you see the sort of the scale of the tragedy that's affecting everybody, but a very big preponderance of young people, including kids. And it's horrible. I mean, I have a daughter myself. The idea that your young family could be in anything like the situation that we see some of these individuals in is just, it's almost unimaginable. But yet, it's happening right now, you know, countries not very far away from us.
And I think you're right in saying that, and children are bearing the brunt of this crisis. And listen, can you shed more light on this? I mean, what other conditions are they exposed to, and what other hardships do they have to endure?
Well, we get a perspective from a doctor I met who was actually going in and out of the refugee camps in Greece. And he was saying, I mean, some basic things like dental health, for example, it's leading to a situation where you have young children who have no access to dental health. So he goes and provides, an NGO which he belongs to goes and provides provisions for dental health, and 65% of those, we think it's a minor issue, you know, but all of us know what it feels like when your teeth is aching, and it's one of the worst pains you can imagine. Mm. And he's saying young children, you know, facing massive dental problems within these refugee camps. But that's just one example of many of the basic health issues which are lacking in those refugee
camps.
There's
also the issue of child exploitation, sex trafficking.
That goes without saying. You know, we've had reports after reports which the UN publishes and also EU publishes of child exploitation. And the other day we had a report which showed that refugees on the boats, they were actually forced to jump off, and led to 50 actually dying. So the smugglers as they were being caught, you know, to force the refugees to come off the boats. So you hear horrific stories like that, and we see that every single day. But in terms of the real situation on the ground, I think many of them have said that they would rather have not made the trip to Europe and have seen that they're actually stuck in refugee camps with no chance of having any kind of asylum or entry into the country. So
it's interesting that you say that. And Nassim, I want to pick up on a point you made just before we went to the clip about how the refugees thought that going to Europe would be the hardest part, but in fact it's the easiest part. Do you think people would be surprised to know this?
I think even our personal experiences, people I've met as well, they say that once they're here, they expect certain level of, you know, certain conditions, certain living standards, and those expectations are not met. And many of them have been stranded, as I said, in camps, some living on streets, hoping that their, you know, lives will improve, but that's the dreams have not really materialized. It's not really dreams, it's basic expectations which they came to Europe for. So we see that, you know, on the streets as well, refugees trying to make a living cleaning windows. You know, these are people who are struggling, you know, they're not being processed properly by the system. Mm-hmm. So we don't know how many of them will actually get any kind of asylum here in the UK. Many in the Scandinavian countries, as Czech Republic, for example, they're actually paying some of the refugees because of their own personal political situations, the far right, you know, getting more and more support. They are actually paying refugees to leave their countries because of their own political situation. The far right moving, thriving in support. So refugees themselves, they said, you know, it's much, much harder now, and they would prefer to have actually not made the journey. We hear that from refugees in Syria. Not to mean that they're all facing this kind of situation. Most refugees would still prefer to live here in Europe, trying for asylum, because situations in Syria, in Afghanistan, those war-torn countries which have been bombarded for the last decade or so, they'd rather be in this situation where they at least have an opportunity to find some kind of a better living condition than face the bombs and the barrel bombs in Syria or in Afghanistan or other parts of the world as well.
And Lee, I want to bring you in on here. So we see after that perilous journey a refugee makes, do you think there'll be some relief at the end? What was your reaction to this scene?
I mean, I think the entire sort of thesis, if you like, of the film is that these people are in purgatory. So you get this disembodied ghost. And it, I mean, the
That's
trailer that you showed at the beginning is like, you know, is this heaven? Is this paradise? And it's like, well, if it's not hell, which it could well be, and you see some of the horrendous situations they're living in, it's certainly this limbo. So they are stuck. They're not, you know, they're not citizens now of any country. They're not being looked after where they are. They can't go back to where they came from. And for me, one of the most nerve-wracking scenes I've seen in any film recently was just after the clip that we showed there, where there's this, the men trying to climb up the huge chains that are moored into the ship to try and get up. And you see this guy going up, and because it's not, you know, Tom Cruise outside an airplane, you know he's safe. But I had no idea if this man was going to make it. And he's very high up. He's really struggling to reach the ship. And it's absolutely nerve-wracking to watch. And you just realize the desperation that you must be, A, to have left your country in the first place, and then still to be trying these very, very sort of risky ways to still, you know, get further away from where you see the danger. So it's really that what it brought it home to me is the desperation and also just the limbo that these people find themselves in. It's heartbreaking.
I think that's a really perfect analogy to describe it as. It's a sense of purgatory and that the struggle's not over. They're neither here nor there. Lee, you were just talking about purgatory, but death is a very harsh reality that the refugees face almost on a constant basis. What did you feel watching this scene?
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting because my understanding is that entire sequence is from a short film that Morgan Knibbe made before Those Who Feel the Fire Burning called Shipwreck, and he's literally just put the whole thing in there. And I think there's even clips from a student film he made in Greece. So he's obviously dedicated a huge amount of his time and energy to putting to this issue. And so to put it all together like this, you know, I don't find the film exploitative, but there's one shot, we didn't show it in that clip, but it's from that same sequence where you just see all these Western journalists and people holding up their cameras and looking into it. And I really got a sense of, like, that's kind of us in a way, because, you know, the average citizen of a European country, we see these images, it's so easy to get inured to them and sort of almost numb to what the reality of, you know, the individual stories. and yet we're constantly fed them.
But we're desensitized.
It's this weird sort of, not parasitic per se, but it's this weird relationship where we're constantly, you know, people are desperate to get that next shot. You know, some of the horrendous images we've seen of the young boy who drowned at sea, or the young boy sitting in the back of the ambulance covered in sort of soot. I mean, they stay with us, but at the same time, it's like, well, is it actually doing anything to make us change our attitude, or, you know, more importantly, the governments of these countries to change their attitude? And that's a really debatable question. I mean, I think the very fact that, you know, a young Dutch filmmaker has spent that amount of time trying to address this issue in a different way is a positive thing. But at the end of the day, you know, it's the change is going to come from, you know, legislation and governments, you know, changing their ideas. And that's, as always, is the big sticking point.
And Nassim, I want to throw that question at you, actually. Does that resonate with you? I mean, what responsibilities do journalists, people in the media have when it comes to covering the refugee crisis?
I mean, that very scene, the first question that came to my mind was, it seems there's a sense of voyeuristic, you know, the cameras, the lenses pointing at the woman crying. Her suffering, for me, in a sense, if you sit within the broader European context, it just seemed there was a disconnect there, because Europe here, the cameraman and the journalist are using this to actually feed a wider anti-refugee, anti-Islamophobic rhetoric that's taking place in Europe at the moment. So for me, they were not using the word exploitation, but I think it was in a sense being exploitative, not the director per se, but the other journalists, because they were using this to show that we are somehow being taken over by these immigrants, these refugees, and we know refugee has shifted politics, not just here in the UK with the Brexit and with Brexit, and also in Europe as well, the rise of the far right, and this is all on the back of the refugee crisis. So those shots, those clips, which we really empathise with, those clips which really give us a sense of what it really feels like to be a refugee and the hardships they face, but they are being exploited to actually show a different narrative to the average person here on the streets in Europe, so that, you know, we are being overrun by refugees, our country's being changed, our culture has been taken over.
Is Europe dealing with the crisis very well?
From a narrative point of view, I don't think it is, because it's showing that somehow, you know, the non-Europeans, Muslims in particular, they're taking over the country, which is statistically it's just completely wrong. It makes no sense whatsoever. 5% of Europeans are Muslims, which is, if you live for another century, the demography will not change much. But I think the rise of the far right is something that's very real, and it's taking place here, not just in Europe, in America, but it's around the world. You know, you see the rise of the far right, and they're exploiting the refugees as the main bandwagon. It's something which they're using to actually push this narrative that we are taken over by Muslims, and which really isn't true. And this kind of movie, hopefully, maybe it might stem the tide of people's emotions and senses as to where, you know, what the real problem is. The problem isn't Muslims coming over. The problem is there's wars in Europe which Europeans have actually helped in supporting. Like Britain is still paying money to the Saudis, and also
it's really interesting that provoked that kind of reaction watching this documentary for you, but I suppose the documentary doesn't address that point so much. But final 20 seconds to you, Lee, what message does this documentary leave you feeling?
Well, I mean, ultimately, even though it's doing it in an unconventional way, it is still very much trying to connect you, the viewer, and probably a Western viewer, to the plight of people from other places who are going through incredible suffering. The fact he's doing it in a more overtly artistic and sort of aestheticized way, then it's debatable whether we get to grips with the facts, but as a sort of a piece of filmmaking, you know, I think it's very valid to try that different approach, but it comes with its pros and its cons.
Well, I'm afraid we'll have to leave it there, gentlemen. Thank you very much for joining the Doc Review sofa. And that's it for this episode of Doc Review. Thank you to both my guests and to you. I've been Camila Shambayati.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
وقضى ربك ألا تعبدوا إلا إياه وبالوالدين إحسانا.
Your Lord has decreed that you shall not worship anyone except Him, and He has enjoined kindness to parents.
For humanity.
Sayyid Abdullah Al-Musawi.
A'udhu billahi min ash-shaytan ar-rajim. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Brothers and sisters, dear listeners, Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh, and welcome to IRIB English Radio, and you are listening to the program For Humanity. We were discussing corruption and how it affects human rights in general, be it on a state level or be it on a global level. As we said, corruption creates a lot of problems and it has a lot of effects, and it leaves a lot of effects in on different dimensions, I should say. Among the effects it leaves an effect on society in general. So I would like to look at some of the effects that leaves on any society when there is corruption happening on a state level, governmental level, or even on a local level, or even between people. No doubt that everything has every action, as we say, has a reaction. So the reactions, sometimes they're not as good as we hope them to be, especially if the action and the act is bad, for sure the effects will be bad too. So amongst the effects that it leaves on the society, if we look at corruption, corruption will lead to questioning the effectiveness of the law and the value and trust and honesty. So people will look at this law that was supposed to be supporting them, that is supposed to be helping them, that's supposed to be offering them help in times of need, but yet that law itself is corrupted, is failing. When it fails, people automatically will question the effectiveness of such law. Should I be an abiding law citizen? If the law itself is not upholding its own rules, its own constitutions, why should I uphold them? If, for example, we say the government themselves or those who are in government are corrupted and are stealing and taking the rights of other people, why can't I do it? So we begin to question, and that system starts to weaken, which it leads, which leads eventually to creating bad behaviors in society, because honesty is gone, trust is gone, law has no value, then what is there left? So naturally, me and you, we start to wonder, we start to question the effectiveness of such laws, and then we say, you know what, we could be better off without them. They restrict us, for example, but it's open to other group of people, and so we have let's say a group of people who are just parasites, and they are depriving the rest of us our rights. So we kind of look down on such a system and such a law. Therefore, we try to refrain. Therefore, we break the law. Therefore, we go against the law. And as you can see, especially in these days, many people in many countries, they're protesting, they raising their voices, they go into the streets, sometimes ends up to riots, and riots all obviously ends up in, destruction, because people are losing trust, and they don't find such laws are effective, are supporting them, giving them what they need. So they say, you know what, we need to take matters in our own hand, because obviously the government is corrupted. Obviously the people who are in charge are not giving us our rights. Therefore, they give themselves the right and legitimacy to take matters in their own hands. And when people do, and when the masses take things in their own hand, then society itself collapses, because as human beings, we were created to follow a system. We created to follow law and order in our nature. But when that fails, then society turns into a jungle. Now, let us take a break and then we continue our talk.
Dear listeners, you are listening to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. You can send us your emails, comments, and questions at EnglishRadio@irib.ir.
Welcome back, brothers and sisters, and you are listening to IRIB English Radio, and we are still talking about the bad negative effects corruption leaves. Amongst the bad effects that corruption leaves on society is the fact that corruption in society leads to a decline in living standards and increases the number of the poor, and socially it will make the poor socially marginalized. So you look at a system, or you look at a country where you see there is a high class and a lower class, and as they use the terminology today, above poverty line and below poverty line. And some people, if they're lucky enough, they are on the poverty line itself, like they are in the middle. This happens, and you can see the margin increases, and that's obviously due to corruption, because if a state or if a system is not dividing the resources equally amongst the citizens, or even globally, when things are not divided equally among the servants of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, among the inhabitants of earth, you will see this margin increases. You see countries extremely poor, and you see countries extremely rich, and you see countries are in between. And we have the audacity to actually classify and give them names: first world countries, second world countries, and third world countries. So every time you hear the word third world countries, we automatically look down at them. Oh, okay, they're poor. Oh, okay, they have nothing. Well, obviously they don't. And who created such a mess? Who made this margin? Who made this division amongst the inhabitants and among the people of Earth? Who deprived those people of their right? Isn't it the countries who are in the first class to begin with? They wouldn't be first class if they have not taken the right of other people, which is a beautiful hadith from Amir al-Mu'mineen alayhi salam. He says, no one has enjoyed a pleasure unless it was taken from someone else, like in terms of, let's say, wealth and stuff like that. So when you look at certain countries without naming names, and you see that living standards are high, technological advances are high, their army's might is high, you can tell automatically that these guys would not get there if they are not draining another system, another country, out of their resources, be it oil, for example, in the Middle East, or be it gold and, I don't know, diamonds in Africa, and so on and so forth. They take from them. The people who live in these lands live in poverty. They have nothing to survive on. They have nothing to live on. While another person in a different state, in a different country, they are a beast. So much food goes to waste, and so on and so forth. So when corruption happens, it automatically leads to the decline in that living standards and increase the number of poor people, and the social marginalization starts to begin, because corruption is always there. So corruption is not something that we should turn a blind eye to or accept or say, you know what, they're doing it, so why not? No, because when that happens and we allow it to continue, then be sure that the rights of human people, their rights will be taken away from them. And me and you, at the end of the day, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala will judge me and you. We say, well, he will say, well, did you make a stand? Did you raise your voice? Did you raise your concern? Did you speak about it when the rights of other people are taken? Or you just don't care, as long as you're fed, as long as you're full, as long as you have safety and a house over your head, then you're good. So sometimes we need to question ourselves and see where we are. We leave you in the hands of Allah Almighty, and inshallah we continue in episodes to come. Until then, take care. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Our website is www.parstoday.com/en.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.